The visibility of success often hides a litany of failure. The desire to hit the jackpot or smash it out of one's park often leaves behind a catalogue of toil and ultimately disappointment. Indeed, should one look beneath the veneer of accomplishment, there are countless souls who were, for one reason or another, unable to bring a lifetime's ambition to fruition. Underachievement is essentially the norm. Even the everyday that we take for granted is typically the result of one lucky break, one person's moment of clarity that propelled it through the melee of flimsier efforts. But rather than glorify the victors in these struggles, this series will recognize and celebrate those who have fallen at the last hurdle. Whether that be through bad luck, ill timing, or crass stupidity, this broadcast will embrace a history of natural born failures. And this group is Legion. I'm Sir General Roland Frampton, and as someone empowered to uphold democracy through the unchecked use of military action back in the day, I have tasted success, but can also identify with the crippling spank of failure. My regiment's frenzied retreat from the Bay of Spaniels in 62 is a regrettable stain, but history reminds us that the fine lines between success and failure are agonizingly thin. Consider how Alfred Nobel secured the rights on nitroglycerin production in 1867 only because his brand name, Dynamite, was eminently more sensible than Frank Stanworthy's Kaboom, a perfectly adequate explosive that never saw the light of day thanks to the speed of the Swedish Patent Office. Consider too history's failure to record the efforts of Professor Colin Frotch, who, while ensconced in Hut 7 at Bletchley Park in 1942, broke the Enigma Code, using only fashionable knitting patterns. Sadly, Frotch suffered a fatal cardiac arrest on his way to report the breakthrough just outside Hut 8. I'll be talking with historians, museum curators, anthropologists, and stupefied family members who've stood wide-eyed in disbelief at some of history's most astonishing botch jobs. The series will explore and recognise the sweat, blood, and tears of all those who didn't quite make the grade. A nod to an extraordinary list of near misses and valiant but somewhat myopic foresight. So, the next time you find yourself describing the beauty of Watson and Crick's discovery of DNA to an intrigued child or puzzled church leader, please bear in mind Evans and Whitlock were stuck in a traffic jam on the number 57 bus, trying to get to the Eagle Pub in Cambridge with precisely the same conclusions. We live in a world of fine margins. A Brief History of Failure, presented by Sir General Roland Frampton, Episode 1, Before Christ. So let us away to prehistory, to the epoch before Christ, when early records of civilization were daubed on the walls of dank caves, and upon discovery gave us the first notions of man's prehistoric existence and his burgeoning ability to fail. In Middle Persia, a place we now know as Iran, artifacts excavated from a region known as Ganj Par attest to a human presence as early as 200,000 BC. Paleolithic art discovered on the walls of caves in the region represent a flourishing ancient culture and point towards a prehistoric urban settlement. Even at this early stage in his existence, man was capable of some quite exquisite artistry, using either bird feathers, animal bones, or a rudimentary etch-a-sketch. Many paintings, however, were of such poor quality that they appear to have been the target of the world's first art critics. In front of me here, deep in these Persian caves, is a stonkingly awful drawing of a horse, and as I look underneath the abhorrent sketch, there is an inscription, Dum, Fum. According to leading paleographists, this legend, Dum, Fum, can roughly be translated as horse no good, fum must die. It's extraordinary that even then, back 200 millennia, art critics were still massive knobs. The last glacial period ended 25,000 years ago, and as the great sheets of the Ice Age melted, a channel formed between continental Europe and the British Isles. Neanderthal man and his significant other were determined to find a way to overcome this natural barrier. With me to tell us more is Professor Hannah Shearchin, who lectures at the University of Bedfordshire.
As the notion of immigration stirred in the befuddled minds of our earliest ancestors, several unsuccessful attempts were made to leave an early version of Calais in France and cross to what was an early version of Dover in England. Archives show how Hugues Agge, a prominent Belgian rock mover, attempted to run across the surface of the channel. After centuries of ice, he had no comprehension of water and drowned instantly. His wife, Hugues Agge, reportedly tried swimming across, but she would also succumb to the waves due to the lack of a robust support team, a slathering of goose fat and violent fits of cramp. Nog Og, an early Dutch mud worker, set about digging a tunnel underneath the channel with his bare hands, but bled to death from the most appalling injuries.
Conventional wisdom suggests at this point in history, failure was now very much part of everyday life. No flame here, a square wheel there, a stone boat somewhere else, and so on. The frequency of fiascos was such that they failed to produce the stigma and ridicule they so richly deserved. There were as yet no WhatsApp groups or social media platforms to decry these efforts, and we would have to wait for the rise of the first civilizations before hopeless failure, in all its forms, was given an appropriate spotlight. Ancient Egypt, 2.5 millennia before Christ, and Khufu has succeeded his father, Sneferu, as the second pharaoh of the 4th dynasty. The new king was nothing if not visionary, and oversaw both the building of the Great Pyramid of Giza and the M75 toll road between Luxor and Cairo. As he approached death, the revered Khufu invited those who could show true worthiness to join his mummy for eternity within the pyramid's tomb. Many did, but Egyptologists have unearthed some who failed to come up to scratch. Joining me in the bowels of Giza's pyramid is Mick Dundee, senior Egyptologist at the University of Sydney. Mick, what do the hieroglyphs tell us of Khufu's repulsed fans?
Well, thanks for having me, Riley. Despite unprecedented levels of looting, Nasir ad-Din, pictured next to me here, was denied passage into the tomb of his beloved leader. Such was the ferocity of his shame, he only went off and stole his mother's front door. We find another here. Queen Hepatitis was something of a celebrity among Egypt's elite at the time. She petitioned her entry into the chamber through her love of liver. But the cipher here tells us her rejection was a result of Khufu's utter contempt for offal. And further along the tomb, we discover Sphinx Man, who felt he was an absolute shoo-in for his services to Egyptian crime fighting. But no, not the case. The decision to spurn Sphinx Man has confounded scholars for decades, but new information that came to light after a recent tomb raid by Cairo Scousers suggests his application stone got lost in the camel post.
The clarity offered by the hieroglyphs represents a watershed moment. We are now at a point in history when calling out these losers would be a matter of course. Simply put, there was nowhere left to hide. The world would no longer allow the hapless efforts of the futile pass without some serious finger-wagging accompanied by childish sniggering. As civilizations expanded and became more advanced, the need for sophisticated gizmos increased exponentially. The flints of the Stone Age were usurped by bronze axes and daggers. In the wattle and daub roundhouses that sheltered our hairy ancestors, pottery was suddenly the big thing if you were to keep up with the Joneses. But while clay cups and plates proved their effectiveness in the home, several early pottery concepts failed on every level. I'm joined by British Museum curator John Throttlecup. John, you have a fine collection of what looks like impractical pottery artifacts here.
Yes, we're often quite astonished at how woefully unviable some of the pieces are that land in our laps. Take this Chinese battle helmet from the First Dynasty, for instance, which was both heavy and violently abrasive for the wearer.
I can't imagine what that would have been like to wear. And these pieces you're holding here?
This clay-fired ashtray is from a Minoan tribe of early adopters. Whilst extremely prescient, it's utterly pointless, given Baki wouldn't be around for another 3,500 years. And these earthenware Egyptian earrings, designed and crafted for Pharaoh Thutmose II, must have hurt like fuck.
John, do we know what became of these, I want to say, craftspeople, but clearly that would be stretching the point.
We've no empirical data as to their fate, but I think it's fairly safe to assume they were put to death.
Around the time that Greece was transitioning to a metal-based economy, the great tales of Greek mythology began to emerge. The origin of stories such as Daedalus and Icarus, Perseus and the Medusa, is largely unknown, but they are believed to have been acquired and transmitted by an ancient oral tradition. However, one myth that failed to become part of this vivid, newfangled storytelling culture was the 6.5 labours of Cocenes. I'm joined by UCLA's antiquities professor, Buckeye Flagstaff.
Great to be with you, Sir Roland.
Buckeye, didn't Cocenes' tale of great deeds predate Hercules' efforts?
Indeed, by some 200 years. Cocenes' first labour, if you will, was to consume the mighty courgette of Minsk. He was adjudged to have failed in this task as A, he didn't manage it in the allotted time of 9 hours, and B, he left the stalky bit at the end. His second and third tasks included wrestling Clive the Unspeakable into two falls or a submission, and banishing Barry the belligerent. He succeeded in doing neither, despite having both parents in attendance. Cocenes failed to capture the giant moth of mirth and simply gave up retiling the downstairs toilet in the Palace of Athens. At this point, it appeared his quest for infamy was slipping from his grasp, but it was halfway through his final labor that Cocenes finally came a cropper.
Wasn't Cocenes required to brandish the colossal sword of Penge?
He was, a bronze weapon purported to be 3 times the height of the Acropolis.
Astonishing.
All seemed well until our blind hero slipped on a patch of St. John's wort and impaled himself on the sword's blade. The poor fellow literally bled out in front of the team of adjudicators. Shocking, really.
Such abject failure in what is a highly improbable story.
Oh yeah, because killing a half-man, half-bull in a maze with a ball of wool is totally believable.
I'm here at perhaps Britain's most famous landmark, Stonehenge, erected on Salisbury Plain as early as 3000 BC. Its stones and their purpose are the subject of much debate among withering intellectuals. Research points to it being an ancient astrolabe, with many gravediggers maintaining that across the centuries, an array of Celtic high priests made alterations to the megalithic structure. However, one dramatic modification installed here between the slaughter stones was to set the hard-earned lessons of timekeeping back decades.
When the Grand Lodge of the Ancient Order of Druids' social secretary, Nor Beaker, had a giant chicken's head positioned between these monoliths, the impact was immediate and devastating.
With me on this windy day is pagan historian Anne Parker. Anne, what was the reaction to Beaker's misguided installation?
So the scene would have been one of total mayhem. The Druid elders, those charged with determining the time of year, were suddenly at odds with everything. They began confusing winter with spring, Christmas with Whitsunday. Dogs started barking at the sun, not the moon. Crops planted in the wrong season failed to materialise, and consequently many parts of the country were thrown into famine. This massive stone chicken head had disrupted the space-time continuum, and its effects were deeply unpopular with the Wiltshire branch of Pagans Reunited.
I understand Nor Beaker was unrepentant.
Oh, absolutely. He decried the reaction to his monument, maintaining it was a, quote, winner-winner chicken dinner. Beaker was subsequently stripped of his title as social secretary, lashed to the stones beside us, and presented to the gods Baulos, hence the provenance of the stone's name.
With its sponsor dead, the chicken head was demolished after just one solstice. World order was eventually restored, but the ancient order of Druids' social calendar would never be as much fun again. Materializing from settlements on Palatine Hill, Rome was finally open for business on or around 753 BC, and a series of observances celebrated the birth of the city. These included mass cheese and wine evenings, grape inhaling, and the advent of a month of gladiatorial taunting at the site where the Pantheon would be built a millennium later. However, several ideas presented for the observances were quickly and quietly shooed away. These included Cato the Younger's submission of Brontosaurus slaying, Acca Pompilius's idea of regional rounds of speed crucifixion, and a proposal for best marrow in show by Alan Titus Martius. With the opening frivolities dispensed with, the Romans could focus on building their city using a Romulus and Remus play kit. But while the Roman Empire was barely a twinkle in the eye, we are now entering the Great Age of Greece. The period around 480 to 430 BC was Greece's golden age. It was a time of great achievements in art, literature, philosophy, science, and generally lounging around. Athens was at the height of its power. Naked Olympians tossed discs and hurled javelins in its amphitheatres, while many of Greece's most famous writers and thinkers minced through its thronging streets and squares. Joining me today in room 19 of the British Museum is Sanjit Jamali, lecturer on Greek philosophy at Karachi University. This must have been a wondrous time with so many smart asses roaming around aimlessly, Sanjit.
Can you imagine, Yar? Popping out for a shami kebab and you run into Plato or Aristotle or Pythagoras.
How does one run into a mathematical equation?
Oh yes, ha, very good.
What?
Oh, Pythagoras was a great philosopher, a polymath in it.
But not all these thinkers made the shortlist for Ancient Greece Has Got Talent, did they?
Far from it, Yar. You had the likes of Septicemius of Rhodes, Doritos of Thebes, Pokemonus of Crete, who all declared an ability for great thought, but literally wouldn't be able to get into a tin of Spam. Take Epidermus of Cyrene, for instance. Couldn't think his way out of a badger trap, yet insisted that he had new revolutionary learnings on planetary science, cultural philosophy, and how to improve the density of a blueberry muffin. But he was a confused man.
His own philosophical theory, codism, wasn't endorsed by any of his peers, indeed any intellectual at the time.
The notion that everyone's mind is powered by fish, or one's memory of a fish, was laughable.
Epidermis was unsurprisingly exiled from Athens. What became of him, Sanjit?
He joined the Spartans as right back.
At the end of Greece's moment in the sun, it was the Romans, the Carthaginians, or the Gauls foisting themselves on some unsuspecting European shithole. Suddenly, all eyes were on the Second Punic War and the deeds of the Carthaginian general, Hannibal Barca. History tells us that Hannibal's most celebrated achievement was the overland crossing of the Alps using 80 war elephants. Rather than take the overnight sleeper from Dijon, Hannibal chose to yomp through the snow-covered Po Valley before descending into northern Italy with not so much as a double espresso. The next 2 years saw Hannibal trounce one Roman army after another as he marched his mighty pachyderms down the spine of Pasta Land. Hannibal was unstoppable as he swept everything before him. Italians fled in terror at the very sight of this marauding army, and Hannibal's victory over Rome was all but assured. Now, his achievement and his legacy would have been vastly different if, at the Mode of Transport Committee meeting in Capus, Hannibal hadn't agreed to suggestions made by his Secretary of War, Hasbro Scortio, to replace the elephants with a fleet of well-trained cockapoos. As Hannibal began his assault on Rome in what should have been a box-ticking exercise, the campaign went violently off the rails as the cockapoos did little more than jump up excitedly at anyone close enough for a lick. Forced to flee, Hannibal made a hasty retreat to the shores of Africa, ensuring that while en route, Scortio made a hasty retreat into extinction. It's 221 BC, and Shi Hang, Emperor of the Jin State in China, orders the building of a great wall. I'm pleased to welcome China's cultural attaché to Finland, Graham Leung, onto the show. Graham, before agreeing to the somber grey stone facade, which we can all see from the moon, I believe the Kingdom of Jin requested design ideas for this impenetrable barrier from its people. Can you give us any idea of what designs failed to stack up and why?
We understand that the Emperor's working party on the wall received well over 1,000 ideas from the much maligned peasants across the state.
Wonderful. Let's take a look.
The first example is from impoverished farmhand Jin Bing, who proposed the Great Potato Wall. This idea actually progressed to the trial stage, but fell foul of potato blight. Next, Xu Anmei, a bamboo artist based in the Gobi, came up with a giant sheep barrier. It was a bold suggestion, but an early pilot scheme simply wandered off. The last proposal we have was the massive money wall designed by Wen Ku. The wall endured a successful trial, but the project quickly ran out of cash.
Graham, what fate awaited the designers and their sorry plans?
The owner of each rejected design was publicly humiliated, had personal property seized, and was slain in front of close relatives.
When Carthage was finally put asunder in 146 BC, the Roman Empire came to the fall. Rome's first triumvirate was established. Pompey, Crassus, and Julius, hater dictator Caesar, formed an alliance whose aim was to control the power of Rome's Senate. While the trio made a promising start, by 44 BC, it all came apart like Blabange sandals. I'm now talking this evening with Dr. Archie McWesp, Head of History at Barnstoneworth High School for Girls.
I'm actually retired now, Sir Roland. Jumped before I was pushed, to be honest, but best not get into that, eh?
Sir Archie, these men, these great warriors, they were highly suspicious of one another, weren't they?
Oh, my days, the Alliance creaked with corruption. Crassus couldn't keep his hands out of the cookie jar. Pompey kept stealing his brother's Play-Doh, while Caesar ran the numbers on the chariot races. Political tensions quickly turned to war when Caesar crossed the Rubicon. I mean, he wanted to go back, but he couldn't. Italy's transition from republic to empire was absolute when Caesar gave the other two a good hiding and took the top job.
Caesar's salad days would not last long, though, would they?
Caesar was barely a year into his internship as dictator when 23 conspirators stabbed him in the Senate. This was followed by another 5 conspirators stabbing him in the groin and the Senate eunuch sticking him in the larynx.
Isn't there some debate over Caesar's immortal death cry, Et tu, Brute?
You refer, of course, to the moment when his most loyal subject, Brutus, went in for a slice of pie. Many eminent scholars, including myself, are at odds over this last utterance. My wife's Pilates teacher maintains he shouted, How do you like those apples?
A second triumvirate swept up the mess of the first before Octavian taught Antony and his Egyptian snake-loving dominatrix a lesson and took a grasp of the monarchy. The title Emperor Augustus was bestowed upon him by the Senate, and this wearer of unnecessarily short togas, open-toed crocs, and heavy and violently abrasive clay helmets ruled the empire until a child was born in the east, and the epoch changed and buggered up the calendar again. Next time on A Brief History of Failure, not everyone would follow the star in the east, and I'll be exploring why certain groups of faith chose such erroneous guiding lights to the Magi.
Me, Abdul, and Clem followed a large firefly for 3 days.
I'll examine the reasons behind treasonous Catholic Guy Fawkes' ill-fated attempt to blow up Parliament.
When one is planning a major act of treason, one should A, remember one's matches, and B, don't post the bloody thing on Facebook.
And as the mood gets nasty in France, I'll be asking why Dragonflight proved less popular than Montgolfier's balloons. All this and more next time on A Brief History of Failure.
A Brief History of Failure was written, produced, and performed by me, Aid Corey. The book of this podcast is available on Amazon.